Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's please take your seat. We are going to resume our session. We'll start with Professor Christian Tamms, who, like anyone, will have 30 minutes to introduce his thoughts on the matter. Christian.
Thank you, Jean. Thank you, Samantha. Thank you, everybody, for being here on this morning. It's wonderful to be here among friends and colleagues and to discuss topics that are dear to our heart. We've heard that consent is a topic for cross-cutting questions. We've heard that it is of historical and ongoing relevance across the field of international law. My presentation is a slight change of gear. It looks at consent in one of the particular settings or fields where it is of relevance, binding dispute resolution. And that shift of focus may bring with it perhaps an element of, if you want to be positive, tangibility, accessibility. It also may perhaps lower the level of reflection that perhaps comes with the choice of the setting. In any event, what I want to say is that in the field of dispute resolution, and this is that something that Samantha has mentioned in opening, consent remains highly significant. And almost that's a truism, you could say. What I want to offer in the next 30 minutes are three reflections, or reflections on three points, that not only is consent in dispute resolution significant, it's also special, because debates about consent in this particular field play out differently than in other settings. That's the first point. Second point related is that this peculiar feature is due to the nature of dispute settlement as a formalized process of resolving disputes with a binding outcome. And in particular, it's due to the fact, and I think that's been hinted at by many, including by Alain in his presentation on treaties, that consent to dispute settlement very clearly is consent to a process, which often uncertain outcomes. And in the course of this process, the relevance of consent or state consent shifts, and control over consent, which is one of the points in the title of my paper, becomes relevant. And so there's a tension between initial state consent and the exercise of control over the meaning of that consent. And that tension, and this is my third point, is best viewed as a question of shifting control over time between different actors. Now, I'll develop those points in three steps. First, by introducing you, and this may be familiar to very many of you, to the foundational role of consent to dispute settlement. Second, by introducing powers of courts that, once given, do control state consent, resulting in this basic tension. And then thirdly, by highlighting, with one or two examples, how that basic tension is navigated in the everyday practice of dispute resolution. Okay, so first, the dominant role of consent in dispute settlement. This is home turf for international lawyers, and I need not say much. And in fact, I'll only say three things. One, and fundamentally, there can be no binding dispute settlement in international law without state consent. State consent, and this is a quote from Jutta Brunet's encyclopedia entry in the Max Planck encyclopedia, retains a sweeping hold on binding dispute settlement, much more than in other fields. And I agree. In the paper, I refer to binding dispute resolution as the heartland of voluntarism. And all this is down to a basic feature: the jurisdiction of international courts and tribunals in international law is based on consent and determined and constrained by state consent. The ICJ calls it the fundamental principle of consent, and in almost every judgment, at least those where preliminary objections to the jurisdictions are upheld, you find a phrase along the lines of jurisdiction of is based on the consent of the parties and confined to the extent accepted by them. And that's not just the ICJ, that is every dispute settlement system that has pronouncements to this effect. Now, second point on this, still on the binding or dominant role of consent, I think, and perhaps there's a slight shift of emphasis, I don't think this is something new or renewed or contingent. I think this is foundational and inherent. It's not been seriously affected, I think, in the major shifts in our approach to dispute resolution, where 20 years ago everybody was hyper-optimistic and thought whether we were moving to compulsory approaches, and nowadays people are talking about backlash. I think the way consent is given has varied, But consent never was seriously in doubt. We've seen historically, if we're willing to treat the last 5 or 10 years as a hiccup, a significant extension of the scope for binding dispute resolution. Then that has sort of materialized in different ways. Consent is given to specialized institutions, specialized courts of tribunals, which render the bulk of the judgments and awards. States give consent in generalized ways. We've seen a move from dispute-specific consent given after a dispute has arisen towards generalized forms of consent previously and antecedently expressed, from compromis, if you want, to compromissory clause. And we see perhaps a particular twist to that, where courts increasingly are integrated into treaty regimes that deal with substantive and procedural aspects of international law and are part and parcel, integrated part and parcel of those regimes, so that if you want to stay out from the court, you have to stay out of the regime. In the WTO, the ECHR, perhaps an UNCLOS. So there are differences in the way consent is being expressed, and a general trend to express it more willingly and in a more generalized manner, but I think it's all consent. And I don't think that is up to sort of discussion or that is up to sort of changes. It's just the modality of expressing consent that has changed. And the third point is all those modes of consent, broad or narrow, post hoc or ad hoc, are special forms of consent, which again make dispute settlement, I think, a slightly different setting. It's almost inevitably visible in writing and formal. Unlike in lawmaking, or, and if we leave aside sort of forum prorogatum, which really is just more the stuff for exams rather than for real life, there is no relevant role for inferred consent based on conduct or silence. Unlike in state responsibility, we hardly ever need to deal with consent by low-ranking state officials or oral promises that were said you could conduct that terror suspect, you from the CIA, and then the question is whether a state has consented to the breach of its sovereignty. We always, in dispute settlement, have formal acts, or almost in terms of practice, nearly always have formal acts, treaties bearing the signature of high-ranking officials, optional clause declarations signed by ambassadors or foreign ministers, and almost inevitably something that is signed, that is on paper. So I think the basic point is that in consent, in dispute settlement, there are relatively few strains in the system, in Bruno Zimmer's terms, and I think this is why it is apt to say consent retains a sweeping hold on dispute resolution. Now you might say we can stop here and that's it, but if we stopped here, we would miss a central aspect. Because as much as I believe in what I've said so far, it is only step one of the process. The decision whether or not there will be a proceeding that results in a binding dispute resolution outcome. And this is where consent has a sweeping hold, is indispensable, cannot be done away with. And this is where it remains, by and large, the free decision of states whether to agree to that or not. Of course, you pay a price if you stay outside the ECHR, you pay a price if you stay outside the WTO, but I think international law works with nudges there rather than with real constraints. Okay, so but what happens after stage one? What happens next? It's a process, and the understanding of dispute resolution as a process is key to appreciating how consent operates beyond this first stage. And this is why I think the notion of consent's sweeping hold only gives us part of the picture. Ellen Hay, in a very different context at one point, wrote of sort of consent to a social process, the outcome of which is undetermined at the time when consent is given. And she used that notion of consent, if you want, consent to a process for understanding treaty processes where treaties are evolving. We'll hear a lot more about that in a separate presentation. Now, but of course it captures also binding dispute settlement because, court cases are famously the ones with uncertain outcomes. In a very different era when our metaphors were different, Germans would refer to the fact that on the high seas and before the courts, you're in the hand of God. Reflecting, I think, that quintessentially before the court, you cannot predict the outcome, or you can only predict and only guess. Now, in international law, that uncertainty only comes into play once consent has been ostensibly given at the later stages. But then, and I think importantly, and this is the second point I want to make, control does shift. international courts and tribunals do take control. And it's not consent that slips away or in the everyday practice can no longer be so relevant, because in customary international law, you cannot be bothered, or unless some sort of states don't care, and when they care, it's too late. It's not practice or, if you want, mere informality or de facto power of international institutions that means that state consent is relegated to second rank. It is a very conscious process, because in binding dispute settlement settings, we are in the presence of express powers granted to international courts and tribunals, which go a significant way towards controlling or curbing the relevance of consent. Just like state consent at stage one is clear and express, so control over state consent and the meaning of that consent shifts clearly and expressly. I would like to mention two powers that courts and tribunals have during the dispute settlement process that seem to create tensions with state consent. The first one is the obvious one, the power to construe the scope of the jurisdictional power of courts, or the power to scope to determine the scope of that jurisdiction. We need state consent, but courts tell us and tell states what this consent means. And they do so as part of a very basic rule of the process, a rule of the game. Nearly all constituent documents of courts and tribunals grant courts the express power to determine the scope of their jurisdiction with binding force. And where such power is not granted expressly, it tops the list of everybody's list of sort of inherent powers, implied powers. There's no doubt that courts have that power. International lawyers refer to it as compétence de la compétence, même en anglais, or compétence, if you want to put the same into one word in German. And it's just, I think, the fact that these curious convolutes of words like compétence can enter the English language textbooks perhaps reflects how clearly settled it is. Now, I think what is not fully appreciated is the tension, or the degree of the tension this creates to state consent. One quote to set us up for that, Alexander Orakelashvili writes about it in the following terms, and I'm quoting, "While jurisdictional instruments are created by state consent, the precise ambit of the jurisdictional conferral depends on the interpretation of these instruments," end of quote. Okay, and that's right, but that is also pretty abstract, and I think it belies the fact that debates about the scope of what have states consented to can be dramatic. It can very often be in doubt what exactly the scope of the jurisdictional conferral is. And of course, it becomes more precarious or more acute as states move towards generalized forms of consent given ex ante, where the clarity and the nexus with the dispute is not so clear. So the potential for unexpected outcomes is very real. We know our examples from international law classes. The US in the 1980s, I think, was genuinely puzzled at the construction of their optional clause declaration and non-construction of their reservation in the Nicaragua case. Perhaps it only pretended to be surprised, but I think some scholars were genuinely puzzled of what the ICJ did with the jurisdictional conferral. One generation later, I think many people were genuinely puzzled at the construction given by the arbitral tribunal to the scope of China's jurisdiction in the South China Sea arbitration award. Investor-state dispute settlement can be read as a series of surprises at what is still included in the grant of jurisdiction by state to investment arbitration. Now, none of this is to say that states are always right. Maybe courts saw the light where states hadn't, but the potential for surprises is real. Now, if we're looking at this from the perspective of state consent or control over consent, all those debates are fruitless. Because the rules regulating the process of binding dispute settlement tell us exactly how the tension is to be solved. Courts and tribunals decide. We can hope they do so meaningfully, persuasively, and perhaps adhering to protocols of interpretation if we believe that they control outcomes. But fundamentally, what we see is an express and a clear shift of authority. Yes, states need to consent, but yes, also courts tell them what they have consented to. Shotaro Hamamoto, I think, put this clearly in a statement that I think is a lot more useful than the naive Orakelashvili quote I cited before. So he says, from a strictly legal point of view, arguments against jurisdictional overreach are without merit. the principle of compétence de la compétence make it practically impossible for any frustrated disputing party to see the decision in question rendered null and void, end of quote. I think that's more hands-on, but I think that captures it, and there's a few caveats that need to be made for occasional systems of sort of internal control, annulment of exit awards, or second-level decisions in the WTO. But if we're looking at it purely from the opposition of states here, courts and tribunals there, then I think it's very little chance for a state to have control, to do anything within the system that regulates the grant of jurisdiction and the interpretation of jurisdiction. So that's the first basic tension with a clear outcome. State consent is indispensable at stage one, at the beginning of the process, but in accepting the jurisdiction of courts, states also have accepted the power of courts to construe what the meaning of that consent is. So second point, more briefly, the second tension, the second loss of control that comes with submitting to binding dispute resolution. This is less clearly defined, and it's not resolved quite so clearly. We're entering, if you want, a more fuzzy debate. And it's the debate on control of the meaning not of titles of jurisdiction, but of the meaning of substantive rules that are at stake in dispute settlement processes. Human rights in ECHR proceedings, investment obligations in ISDS, maritime boundary delimitation rules in before the ICJ, or subsidies in WTO law, whatever may be the substantive aspect that is subjected to dispute resolution. Now, consent to jurisdiction, of course, is fundamentally consent to accepting an outcome. The award, the judgment must be binding, and states must subscribe to that ex ante, otherwise it would not make sense to talk about it as binding dispute resolutions. But the question is, what does it mean from the perspective of state consent? Not much, you could say. I think it's clear that if, for example, Ukraine sues Russia for abusive allegations of genocide, which are used for bad purposes, it's very clear that the ICJ has the power to determine whether this falls within the scope of the Genocide Convention or is just a creative construction that has nothing to do with the Genocide Convention. And that's relatively obvious. I think the tension with consent arises not in the individual dispute that is sub judice, but with follow-up consequences or potential follow-up consequences of judicial interpretations. And the key question there arising is to what extent courts, through settling disputes, can shape and control the meaning of rules of law beyond the individual disputes. Can they make law through their decisions? Can they contribute to legal development? And international law on this question is famously uncertain or unclear. Unclear because we proceed, and I'm simplifying somewhat, from very naive protestations and constituent documents, which want to reduce the binding effect of judgments to inter partes validity, where in Article 59 of the ICJ statute or Article 46 of the ECHR, you have the clear distinction that the decision is only binding between the parties and in respect of the dispute submitted before the court. And I think we have real life confronting that naive protestation, real life that will naturally nudge people towards precedential argument in systems that are developed and work with repeat adjudication, the persuasive power of judicial reasoning, the intuitive appeal, and of course then also the fact that as international lawyers struggling with a system that has too few authoritative interpreters, we will desperately want someone with assumed authority who tells us what the law means and thereby reduces the power for auto-interpretation and uncertainty. So quite how that is played out is not entirely clear. I think we're somewhere stuck between courts cannot officially make law, but they clearly do more than just through their reasoning solve a particular dispute. But quite how that plays out is depending, I would say, on each individual court system, and I'll say a bit more on that in a minute. But the key point then for the second part of my presentation is that state consent to binding dispute settlement is beset by tensions indispensable to provide access, control during the process as far as the scope of jurisdiction is concerned, and under stress as far as the substantive meaning or the meaning of substantive rules is concerned, where we see a battle of interpretative or a battle over or a struggle over interpretative authority about the meaning of rules. Okay, So the third part then, how is that played out, these basic tensions? How do they play out in the everyday practice of binding dispute settlement in a constant process of adaptations? This is, of course, a question that could be discussed from sort of dozens of angles. I'll pick two which tie in with the two tensions I've outlined just now. The first is a continuation almost of the debate I've just mentioned, the struggle over interpretative authority. So who controls the meaning of substantive rules? And more particularly, can courts, through their decisions, shape the meaning of rules in a way that would enable development beyond initial state consent, or at least downgrade the role of initial state consent, because the development by courts through their jurisprudence would be part of the mix. Now, the basic point is that this depends, or the degree to which there's a tension depends on the dispute settlement regime and fairly basic factors. It depends on the number of cases that courts decide. You cannot control much meaning with two decisions per year. It depends on the scope of the issues that arise. You can only control meaning effectively if you have a chance to revisit and refine and fine-tune your interpretation of rules. So if you want a human rights court only adjudicating on, let's say, 10 basic freedoms, is always more likely to exercise meaningful control than a court without a home turf that pronounces on everything, but only rarely consecutively. And it also is perhaps a question of the compliance rate and the question of whether there are rival interpreters. If you are the only guardian of a treaty regime, you are likely to have more authority over the meaning of that convention or that treaty than if you are one among many voices trying to tell the world what a particular treaty rule means. I think what we can see, and I think this is true for all regimes, are claims to authority, assertions of authority. And simplistically, this is a bit crude, but they would also typically see courts moving towards greater or asserting greater forms of authority, greater degrees of control, and states resisting that. So we see that played out everywhere, from states seeking to reassert control over investment treaties to, say, the appellate body of the WTO, over time beginning to proclaim that its own decisions were part of the acquis of the WTO, and therefore, to understand what the WTO means, you would need to look at the appellate body jurisprudence, which becomes part and parcel of what states are owing each other under this particular treaty. So two perhaps instructive recent moves in this constant struggle for authority. I think from a court side, the most interesting developments, or most frightening developments, depending on how you see it, are in the ECHR. We see the most robust assertion of court control over the substantive meaning of provisions, and it began early on. So Ireland, UK, the ECHR said even in the 70s that its decisions were not only to serve to decide cases brought before the court, but more generally to elucidate, safeguard, and develop the rules instituted by the convention, thereby contributing to the observance by the states of the engagements undertaken by them as contracting parties. So it's not just settling a dispute, it's also developing the rules, and the clear message is the rules with a view to future instantiations of human rights compliance. And you see it very clearly sort of three decades on in cases where this is much more developed. Opus versus Turkey is one quote that I noted down. The court will consider, in brackets, in determining an individual case, the court will consider whether the national authorities have sufficiently taken into account the principles flowing from its judgments on similar issues, even when they concern other states, end of quote. So as a Turkish prison authority, if you want to be compliant with the ECHR, lots of ifs there, but you need to not look at just the text of the convention, but also at how it's been construed in cases against other states over the decades. So compliance with principles is part of your state duty to comply with rulings. Little remains of inter partes validity, and I think it's clear that, I mean, Samantha and others have spoken about this and tried to rationalize it. It's edging towards erga omnes effects of decisions, or in the ECHR context, perhaps the rival terminology, the principle of res interpretata, which becomes part of the convention control. This is, I think, where we're heading to despite meek and meager state protests. Much more briefly, contrast this to ISDS, investor-state dispute settlement, also a field where you see a battle over control. There, I think the key move is states reasserting or trying to reassert control by being a lot more prescriptive in formulating rules, and notably by, in more recent treaties, instituting rival interpreters by setting up treaty committees that are given the power to interpret with binding force how rules are to be understood. And so these are rival institutions to the courts, and their existence and their creation is a clear message to courts that they must not be that they must be a bit cautious in ascribing meaning beyond an individual dispute to a particular investment obligation. So, but the key takeaway is, I think, as if we're looking at this tension, and on that I'll end at least for this first point, not the first point, the penultimate point, in case Jean was about to faint, is that this is waged within each jurisdictional regime. It's very difficult, I think, to generalize beyond that. Now, final point. I think this is different to the other debate I want to mention, control over the scope of jurisdiction. Here we do have a clear role. Yes, states need to consent, but yes, also courts tell them what that consent means as part of their compétence de la compétence. So there's really little room for struggles from within of the type that characterized the first debate I was highlighting or summarizing. It's clear that courts possess authority. That's a given. And from a state perspective, there's no point in arguing against this. I mean, you see China protesting against courts sort of being sort of engaging in mandate creep in the South China Sea case, and the US did the same. And yeah, of course you say that, but what can you do from within the system? You can do really nothing. So the real response is exit. You have to live with the outcome in an individual case that you don't like, but you withdraw consent pro futuro. And this is what states do quite regularly, and perhaps more regularly than we tend to acknowledge in the general dispute settlement literature. I mean, again, Nicaragua resulted in a US withdrawal, whether that was sort of a pretext or otherwise is neither here nor there. Exit was the option left to the US, so no optional clause declaration since Nicaragua. Constant nuisances by Iranian cases brought against the US under the Treaty of Amity resulted belatedly in the 2010s in the US withdrawal from that treaty. In ISDS, you have European states looking with sort of disbelief at the chance offered to them by the Achmea judgment of getting out of investor-state litigation in intra-EU BITs, and belatedly, I mean, they've now had a five-year campaign of sort of withdrawing from that aspect of ISDS. Yesterday, I think, crowned with the first success where a tribunal has held that it couldn't exercise jurisdiction over intra-EU BITs. And again, exit is the option because states agree on moving out of those treaties and disapplying treaties. And we can deplore all of that, or we can celebrate it in investment arbitration, depending on our perspectives on this. We can also argue about the plausibility of a particular court construction and whether it's really overreach or just a meaningful construction allowing for effective dispute settlement. But the key point is a much simpler one that I want to make. There is no room for struggling from within. Exit is what states do if they are really unhappy. And of course, there's a barrier to exit because it comes at a lot, much more of a price. But the debate is fought out through these crude measures of compliance or coercing compliance or just stopping short of exiting or exiting. So I think the two pictures that I wanted to sketch out give us very different ways of navigating the tension. In one case, sort of constant struggles from within. In the other, exit as the main response for states that are unhappy. Final point, 30 seconds, where does this leave us? I think the key point, if we're stepping back from these individual instances, is my attempt again to sort of highlight comparatively the role of consent in dispute settlement. Of course, I'm guessing a bit because we will still hear lots of presentations on other fields, but I think the main lesson to me seems that all of this is explicitly regulated by requiring state consent so that the process can begin, and at least in the case of compétence de la compétence, explicitly regulated so that we know what powers the other actor, main actor, courts have in the process. So consent is part of the dispute settlement DNA, if you want, but so are the limitations on consent. And I think both in requiring consent and in limiting consent, international law in the field of dispute resolution is a lot clearer, a lot firmer, and a lot more express than in other fields where consent is at play. That's all I wanted to say. Thank you for your attention.